thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
People can't believe it when the man waved back.
Mm-hmm. Here's John Williams.
He sounded a little Anthony Hopkins there, didn't I, with that sort of sinister whisper. Hi, it's John. It's 110. I'm in the Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue. We're here until 3 o'clock, and appreciate you tuning in. Join us along the way if you like. We'd like it if you did. The number is 312-981-7200. You know, once upon a time, living to be 73 years old used to be a nice run. 73 now feels young, doesn't it? Somebody passes away at the age of 73, and you say, wow, that's sooner than it should have been. Even if it's cancer, and that's how Jonathan Demme has passed away, the Oscar-winning director has died. And then you start to think about the guy and the films that he's made. We got the IMDb out on him. 1978, he directed an episode of Columbo. It was a very unusual Columbo. In that particular episode of Columbo, Columbo ate someone's liver. 1980, he directed Melvin and Howard. 1984, Swing Shift. That was kind of fun. 1988, Married to the Mob. That was awesome. Red Hot and Blue, a TV movie he did in 1990. He's all over the map. He did things like concert films, a lot of musician documentaries. He did TV episodes. He did famous movies, of course. Silence of the Lambs in 1991, then Philadelphia in 1993. He did Storefront Hitchcock, a documentary, in 1998. He did a video documentary, The Pretenders' Greatest Hits, in 2000. The Agronomist, I'll bet you didn't see that, a documentary in 03. The 2004 version of The Manchurian Candidate he directed, Neil Young, Heart of Gold, documentary 06. Another Neil Young documentary in 09. Another Neil Young documentary in 2011. All the way up to some works of late. Following Silence of the Lambs, Demme used his clout to make Philadelphia one of the first major studio films to tackle the AIDS crisis, and a movie that won Tom Hanks his first Oscar. The director most recently worked on an episode of the Fox police drama Shots Fired. That's scheduled to air April 26, the same day Demme's death was announced. What's today's date? Today is April 26. Wonder if they're going to run that. He also filmed the 2016 concert film Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids. His most recent narrative feature was 2015's Ricky and the Flash, starring Meryl Streep as an aging rocker who must return home to Indiana due to a family crisis. The film disappointed at the box office. The reviews were muted. But if I say Jonathan Demme, you say Silence of the Lambs. If I say Silence of the Lambs, what comes to mind? Quick. I know what it is. So here's two scenes from Silence of the Lambs. The first one is noteworthy, not because it has a really great line in it, although just about everything that comes out of Anthony Hopkins' mouth in this is memorable, and Jodie Foster, too. But in this particular scene, it's where she first encounters him. He's locked up. The FBI has sent her a student in to engage him. He's a little insulted that they didn't send somebody higher up, a student. And there's a scene where he lifts his nose up and smells the air around her, and he tells her things about herself that somewhat unnerves her.
Dr. Lecter, my name is Clarice Starling. May I speak with you?
You're one of Jack Crawford's, aren't you?
I am, yes.
May I see your credentials?
Certainly.
Closer, please. Closer.
Don't get closer, Jody. Don't.
That expires in 1 week. You're not real FBI, are you?
I'm still in training at the academy.
Jack Crawford sent a trainee to me.
Yes, I'm a student.
Sit, please.
Don't sit. Don't sit.
You use Evian skin cream. And sometimes you wear lead at home. But not today.
Oh, man. That's good.
It just gives you the chills.
Oh. This psychopathic killer says, sometimes you wear l'air de temps, but not today. And you know that she knows, that he knows, that. And that's just, hi, how are you? That's, hey, you want to spend some time together? Holy cow. Later in the movie, she's got a little bit of the upper hand, but he tries to smack that down, and that leads to this famous scene.
Do you know what you look like to me with your good bag and your cheap shoes? You look like a rube, a well-scrubbed hustling rube with a little taste. But you're not more than one generation from poor wire trash, are you, Agent Starling? And that accent you've tried so desperately to shed, pure West Virginia.
You see a lot, Doctor. Or are you strong enough to point that high-powered perception at yourself? What about it? Why don't you look at yourself and write down what you see? And maybe you're afraid to.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
You're sitting there with a bucket of popcorn, maybe some jujubes, and you just go, oh, God.
I've never seen that movie solely because I know that I would probably have nightmares for a year.
Producer Elle, if you have not watched Silence of the Lambs.
You have to see it, but you have to see it with someone else, and you have to have all the lights on.
Okay. Maybe I'll just follow those instructions then.
I've actually, every now and then when I discover somebody who does not have a particular motion picture in their personal inventory, I criticize them. You can't be an American if you haven't seen at least the first episode of The Godfather. You need to have watched Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. We all have our movies, which are touchstone, and we think are enough a part of the American fabric that you need to have seen. How can you tell me that you didn't see X? And it's not the same list for everybody, right? So, for instance, Star Wars might not be on my list, but it is on yours. I'm not sure if Silence of the Lambs is on that list, but boy, I do think you need to see that. I think you need to see Silence of the Lambs because you need to know what it's about. You need to know what the fava beans thing is about. If somebody comes up to you and they go, you need to know the reference of that.
Well, you don't think that I would be psychologically.
Oh, yeah, you would be damaged goods.
Ruined.
No,
yeah.
you are no emotional place to watch this. It'll ruin you.
Are you being sarcastic now?
I don't know the answer to that question. By the way, are there any other, Kim, would you say, are there some movies that all good, taxpaying, red-blooded, God-fearing Americans need to have seen?
Oh, absolutely.
And so what's on that list?
Are you talking scary or are you talking just anything?
I think anything. It's just part of the American fabric. For instance,
I think the American president with Michael Douglas is, part of the America, I think president, that pops into my head.
Yeah, I know. I love that movie.
That's my favorite. One of my favorites.
But here's what troubles me about that one. Liberals love that movie. Maybe news people love that movie. And those aren't necessarily the same thing. But I know some conservatives probably don't love an American president. I'm just guessing.
I'm sorry.
Here's one. I think everybody needs to have seen The Graduate. Would you agree with me on that?
I have not seen The Graduate, believe it or not.
Good Lord. Wow.
So, I mean, Wendy hasn't seen The Sound of Music. Now, that's just, I don't even know what that is.
That's un-American.
That's un-American.
And she's
that's
on this radio station?
Yes, she hasn't seen The Sound of Music.
Well, wait till I tell Todd Manley about this.
I mean, I think if it were me, I've seen every Julie Andrews movie there is. That's just un-American not to see her movies.
We were in Europe last fall. We were on the Danube. And we went through the area, saw the same scenes where they filmed that movie. It's positively lovely. Just lovely, lovely, lovely. But a lot of stuff is taken out of context, and some of the spaces don't exist the way they show them in the movie theater. But whatever, in the movie. It's a beautiful part of the world, if you ever get a chance to do that. If you want to chime in, my number's 312. Oh, yeah, I think Kevin's probably right here. Kevin, jump in here. You're on the air. Hi, Kevin. You're on WGN. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Kevin. What's up?
Hey, just two other movies that are on my list, besides The Godfather, as you mentioned. But Princess Bride, every time that's on, I watch that movie, no matter what part of the movie it's in.
Yeah.
And Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah. See, and I'm not going to quibble with you because everybody gets to have their own list. To me, it's not your favorite movie or the greatest movies. It's movies that are so part of the, I hate to put it this way, but like the American fabric, like all Americans mm-hmm. should know about that. And I so in that case, I would say Shawshank trumps Princess Bride, but you get to make your own list. Those you want your friends and your kids to have seen that movie, right, Kevin?
Absolutely. I want everybody to see Princess Bride. It is to me like one of the absolute greatest movies ever made.
Hey, thanks for the call, Kevin. I've got a note here. I appreciate you joining us. Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's also like Schindler's List. It's one of those movies that you have to see. It's not necessarily that you enjoy watching it, but you want your children to see that. You need people to know what happened.
I put off watching that thing forever.
Me too.
Because I just thought, oh, I know it's important. I'm glad they made it. Message received. Got it. Don't want to watch it. Don't want to watch it. I want movies to take me to happy places, not necessarily enlightened places, and that movie wouldn't do that. Let's talk to Joanne. Joanne, this is John. You're on the air. What did you want to say?
Hi. I just want to say, first of all, thank you for coming back. We really enjoy having you.
Oh, thank you.
And I think two movies should be Gone with the Wind, which I remember doing a study in high school and fell in love with it.
Completely agree with you on that, yeah.
Totally with you on that.
It's a Wonderful Life, just kind of a classic.
And It's a Wonderful Life, yeah. Boy, you almost, we could, if we go down the Christmas rabbit hole on this, we'll never come up for air, but you're totally right. I would say It's a Wonderful Life and Gone with the Wind. You need to have seen. Literally, if they taught that in high school, I would be okay with that. If my kid came home and said, Dad, I don't know what 6 times 8 is, but in the second act of this one movie, I would say time well spent.
Thank you.
Thanks for the phone call. We agree on that. Carl, you're on the air. And, you know, and as a result, I think you can't know which movies are so part of the American zeitgeist that we all need to have seen them. You can't know right away. They kind of have to steep for a while. And so then after 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, whatever, you go, wow, that one still means something to me. So it almost takes a little while. Just because it's killing at the box office now, it's almost too soon. You need a little distance. And we got into this conversation because of Jonathan Demme's passing and my wondering out loud if Silence of the Lambs is one of those touchstone movies for us. But I would absolutely put Gone with the Wind on there. And I don't even know if that's a hole in my probably movie resume. I'm sure I've seen it, but I sure can't remember the last time I sat down and watched the whole thing. But I would almost say you will be hard-pressed to beat The Graduate in this little scheme of mine. Very quotable, famous stars, said something about society at the time, still makes sense today. If I come up to you and say plastics, you need to know what that means. And it means it was in that movie, and it means something because it was said in that movie. It's 123 on WGS.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Even the way he says Chianti is unpredictable in that scene. Golly. By the way, Pat wanted to chime in just with a movie that you need to have on your resume if you're going to be an American. What is that, Pat?
Well, I love the movie with Gone with the Wind, but being Italian, some of the movies that were based on true stories, the movie with Johnny Depp, where he infiltrated the Joseph D. Pistone, infiltrated the mafia in New York. And of course, Goodfellas and Casino, which is based on the Chicago organized crime in Las Vegas and the Spilatro brothers. Some of those movies are just, you know, especially if you're lucky enough to, you know, especially like with Pistone and him and, what's his name, Pacino working together. I mean, those are some amazing movies.
Well, you told Elif, our producer, that Rocky, obviously the first one, that should be on everybody's resume. Yeah. And I think you're right about that, too. You know, when I get to be king, I may just appoint Pat in charge of this because I think he's got a good eye and an ear for this. So what do you think the name of that movie is? Because I know exactly the one he's talking about where he infiltrated the mob, Johnny Depp. What do you think the name of that was, Elif? What was the name of that movie? Huh? 128. This is WGN. Okay, here comes the news. After the news, let's talk about the story about how you tell me if this is a good idea. Maybe you love it. Maybe every now and then I turn around and think there's a parade behind me. There ain't one. But I'm not a big fan of public shaming, even state lawmakers. We'll get to that in a little bit.
In June, a city hot for hockey welcomes the hockey.
I thank you, Kim. It's 137. This is John, and I'm in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. It's a lovely day downtown Chicago. Actually, some clouds, but the sun's cutting through, and the tulips are about 3 feet tall. Flower gardens just look beautiful downtown right now. Kim, were you a waitress or a bartender at any time? Did you ever live on or benefit from tips?
No. I worked at a concession stand, but there were no tips.
Yeah. I guess there could have been.
And then I worked for my dad.
No tips there.
And he had a delicatessen, no tips there at all.
Yeah. Oh, really? A deli? And you never got tips at the deli?
Well, I wasn't allowed.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, and it was kind of a self-serve thing, so nobody really tipped you.
You see what Greg Popovich did, the coach of the San Antonio Spurs? Says here he's a better tipper than he is a basketball coach, and that's saying something. The 68-year-old San Antonio Spurs head coach had a bill. In fact, they actually posted it online. He bought dinner. I don't know what all was on the I don't know what all they ordered, if it was a bunch of meals or beverages, but the bill came to $815.73. I lost it. I'm trying to see how many people were on that. But that could be four. That could be four people at a nice restaurant if you're ordering nice wine. And
yeah, and a couple drinks and dessert and coffee, sure.
He left a $5,000 tip.
Wow.
How much fun is that?
How nice is that?
That is the most fun. I don't know, probably even more fun than being that rich is then being able to do stuff like that. Leaving a $5,000 tip has just got to be the funnest thing to do in the world. Maybe even more fun than getting a $5,000 tip. No, I take that back. It's more fun to get the $5,000 tip.
Course, yeah, but sometimes, you know, to pay it forward and do something good for somebody just really does warm your heart and make you feel good.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the guy with the $5,000 tip who's doing that, he can almost always they can afford it. You never hear about the guy that leaves $5,000 as a tip and that was his last dime. They're usually high rollers, and life's great for them. And you're right, they're just paying it forward a little bit. The restaurant owner would not say whether Popovich had dined there recently, according to the San Antonio Express News, but the signature posted online sure looks like his. Greg Popovich at McEwen's on Monroe in Memphis, Tennessee. They were there playing basketball, and he's a funny guy anyway. He's a weird interview. He's a non-interview. He's famous.
Quirky or?
He doesn't like to answer questions, and everybody sort of gets it. But anyway, $5,815 for dinner. So that's kind of cool. And then maybe we'll talk more about this tomorrow or the next day. But we started to look up other famous tips. And one of them comes through Chicago in a sort of roundabout way. At least, yeah, this is a Chicago reference here. Colleen Gallagher, a Chicago cocktail waitress. I don't have a date on this, but this is at abcnews.go.com/business story. Well, if I don't know when this happened, but here's the story. Colleen Gallagher, Chicago cocktail waitress, received an $11,000 tip from a Massachusetts businessman after she had bared her soul to him about life's travails. "This is a miracle. It's really a blessing," said the 26-year-old single mother of two. "I'm so thankful for him. He changed my life." Gallagher's guardian angel is John Bach, chief executive officer of Meridian Investments, Inc. of Quincy, Massachusetts, who struck up a conversation with the waitress while he was there at her place of employment, the Excalibur Dance Club. In April, I'm not sure what year, maybe this year, Gallagher told him she was struggling to make ends meet and find decent housing. Bach, who had gone to Chicago on business, initially told Gallagher to add $1,000 as a tip. He paid his bill for $60 with a credit card, but then said add $1,000. Bach offered Gallagher the additional money, according to accounts, by pulling out a thick wad of credit cards and fanning them before her and telling her to, quote, pick a card. I reached in and picked one, Gallagher told the newspaper. It was a platinum Visa, and he said, take that card and go give yourself $10,000. Life's too short to be feeling blue. Colleagues of Bach told the Boston Herald that he's known for his charity donations and has given large tips before, but $11,000 was uncommon even by his standards. Gallagher said she's going to put the money in the bank and that she intends to use it to take care of her sons, 6-year-old Daniel and 2-year-old Dylan. Last year, Melanie Usen, a waitress at another of the city's night spots owned by A La Carte Entertainment, took in $10,000 as a tip on a $9 drink. That time, the waitress almost lost the bonus when the English doctor who left it turned out to have exceeded his credit limit. That's embarrassing. Throwing around some coin and then it doesn't work. The owner of the bar stepped in and offered to cover the amount. So there's that. Speaking of cash money, we have a couple of state lawmakers, you probably saw this story or heard about it in the Chicago Tribune, who have not paid their taxes from 2014. The Tribune had a disclosure published online April 14th that two Illinois lawmakers have yet to file their 2014 state tax returns, which were due 2 years ago. Because of confidentiality laws, the Illinois Department of Revenue would not identify the two state house stragglers. A spokesperson for the agency, part of Bruce Rauner's administration, said it supports a bill that would publicly shame them. Under the proposed law here in Illinois, lawmaker names would be made public 6 months after they receive notices that they are delinquent in filing state tax returns. They could avoid the public disclosure if they file before the 6 months pass. McSweeney, that would be the state lawmaker who is proposing this, David McSweeney of Barrington Hills, said he would prefer that the names be posted on a state website, though the bill he filed Monday also would allow the names to be made available for public inspection at the Department of Revenue. The two lawmakers are among 312 people getting state checks who have been slapped with a $250 penalty for tax delinquency. See, to me, the way you punish these people or motivate these people or get even with these people is you slap them with a fine. And then we'll get our money that way, eventually. I'm not a big fan of public shaming. Every now and then you'll see a kid standing on a busy street's corner and they'll have one of those sandwich boards or a sign that said, I didn't do my homework, or I hit the teacher, or I spoke badly to my mom. Whatever the crime of the house is, the kid is standing there. You've seen these stories before, and they have to stay there all day long. Sometimes judges actually impose that as a sentence on some people who break the law. You will stand on the corner of X and Y, and you will be publicly shamed. I'm not sure that works. I think that just ticks people off and embarrasses them and makes the judge or the mom feel good. I just don't believe that's a real effective way to do it. The way to do this is to, I don't know, penalize them or fire them or tow their car away. But you want to publicly shame them? Do you think that? I don't defend the public lawmakers this way. I'm not saying that they don't deserve some sort of scorn. What they need to do is pay their taxes. But putting them up at the Department of Revenue, I guess we could put posters in the post offices. Maybe we could get one of those digital billboards off the Kennedy or one of the major expressways, and we could flash their face and what they owe the state up there. Now, I know the reason it does begin to make sense is because these are the same clowns that aren't getting your bills paid on time, so why not shame them because they're not even paying into the system? But I'm just not a fan. My number's 312-981-7200. We'll take your calls next on WGN. The big story today, of course, is about the president's tax proposal. As I understand it, we're going to get into this in the 2 o'clock hour. No one will ever have to pay taxes again, and we're going to build railroads, airports, and superhighways all throughout the land. I'm mocking it, aren't I? I don't mean to be. I hope he can pull this off. If he can lower everybody's taxes, do the infrastructure spending, and not cripple our grandkids with debt, I am so on board. We'll see how realistic that is in the next hour. You can do something new and exciting. Take dance lessons at Arthur Murray Centers. It's fun. It's a great bit of exercise, and it's an excellent stress reliever. It's the perfect date night, too. Right now, you and your significant other can get a private lesson for just $40. They've got 9 Chicagoland locations. Call this number, 312-644-7554. 312-644-7554. Or go to chicagoarthurmurray.com and start dancing today. It's $150. A tip call and a, hey, should we shame the public, legislators who don't pay their taxes? We'll start with Mike on tipping. Mike, you're on WGN. What's up?
Hey, yeah. You were talking about the paying it forward with tips earlier with Popovich, right?
Yep.
Well, I was down in the Dominican at a destination wedding, and a bunch of us were playing golf, and we had all been caddies in the past. Caddy that was with us was amazing, and we all decided to just throw him a couple $100 apiece to, you know, say thank you and pay it forward, and you did a good job. And he kind of like half started crying, and he was saying, this is going to pay for my family for a month, food, like living, everything. And all of us were just like, that felt about as good as anything I could imagine. So there's no doubt that we'll pay it forward to those who work for tips goes a long way for your own heart, you know?
Wow. So 4 of you, maybe the kids now got $1,000, $1,200, something like that, huh?
Yeah, and he had 3 kids.
Golly. Good for you. Mike, I'm glad you told us that story.
Thanks.
Have a good day. Wow. By the way, back to state lawmakers. Nancy, you're on WGN. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. You had said you're against public shaming of politicians.
Yeah.
That they should be fined. Well, they are already fined, and that doesn't stop them from not paying their taxes.
Yeah, I
know. So why not just don't write them a check until their taxes are cleared.
I like that. That's kind of the thing I didn't really express well. They should be punished. I'm not sure how, but
everyone is punished if they don't pay their taxes, but it doesn't encourage them to pay anyway.
Yeah.
But why not any government worker not get a dollar from the government until their taxes are at a zero balance?
I don't think that's a bad idea, Nancy. I think you're onto something there.
Yeah. Yeah. And then regarding that pay it forward thing, I was at a restaurant and somebody, because I have a handicapped son, paid out of the blue blindfold, they paid my bill. And I thought, well, that's unnecessary. So I said, okay, why don't you pay the next person's bill? So I looked at a table across the way, I said, you pay their bill. And I said, and tell them, and it just made me feel good, and I hope that other people continue that. It was a good feeling.
Wait a minute. So they said, hey, we'll pay for you and your child, and you said, oh, that's not necessary. Do it for somebody who might need it more than me. And then
No. They paid my bill and left. I didn't know it until it was time for me to pay my bill. It was a nice restaurant at downtown Chicago.
Yeah.
And so I said, okay, I feel funny about this. I was honored, but I said, I picked out somebody else. I said, anonymously, go pay their bill. I paid with my credit card their bill, and then I hope that they maybe paid it forward as well.
Yeah, no kidding. But did I hear you somewhere in all of that say table of 12?
No. We were table of 4.
Oh, okay.
Table of 4.
Yeah.
Because my son, I think they did it because they thought my son was in a wheelchair. I don't know, and just decided to pay my bill anonymously.
How about that?
I paid somebody else's bill anonymously.
That's nice of you to do that, Nancy. I'm going to tell you a story, too. Thank you for the call. This is just another one of these sort of great tip stories that Elif dug up. Erin Collins always felt sympathetic towards those who worked in the service industry after working in a pizzeria and watching his best friend work as a waitress while going to school. So he added a stipulation to his will. He asked his family to leave a $500 tip at a restaurant when he dies. That a 30-year-old would think like that is surprising, but what is also surprising and sad is that the 30-year-old died unexpectedly. And because he did not leave money to his relatives to complete the last wish, maybe he wasn't thinking he was going to pass away, his brother put up a website to collect donations. They thought maybe we'll get $500 or maybe we'll get even more. So far, they have over $65,000. And they go to restaurants and they leave gigantic tips. The website set up last year has 65,000. So far, they've given out 22,000. The restaurants are chosen randomly, and the servers receive the tip no matter how good the quality of service. I like that, too. It's coming up on 155. We'll pause for the news in a second. And then we'll visit with Elizabeth Rosenthal, who was briefly on with Ro Khan not that long ago. They were talking about health care. Her book is An American Sickness. She's in town. Ro and I both spent a lot of time with this book, and this book is really good to read. You probably don't want to read a book about the American healthcare system, do you? But I'm telling you, the stories in here, it's like one really amazing anecdote that makes a really good point after another. So it's kind of a very recognizable scene after scene after scene. You go, yeah, why does that happen? How did that happen? I know somebody that happened to, too. So I want to know what her take is on where we are right now. We'll tell some amazing stories along those lines. And then we'll visit with the CNN senior writer and editor, Heather Long, on the proposed tax cut versus tax reform debate that's taking place. The president said Wednesday he's got a really big plan. It's come out today. And the tax cuts sound really huge. I mean, who's not for them? The only thing I'm trying to do here is get a reality check in the next hour. Can you really cut taxes that much? Maybe we'll close the loopholes so, in fact, as much money will go to the Treasury as before. But they're going to cut taxes tremendously for some people, but they're still planning to spend a lot on infrastructure. And I guess one way to do that is just to pile it all on the debt. But is that what this is? We'll answer those questions coming up on GM.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
We're doing very well in healthcare. We'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Here's John Williams.
Yeah, here I am, 207. We're in the Showcase Studio, the Allstate Showcase.
Lord have mercy.
Studio on Michigan Avenue, and the sun keeps pounding through the clouds. It's a lovely day downtown Chicago. And in our studio is the author of An American Sickness, Elizabeth Rosenthal. She is the, is it editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News? Is that right? Longtime reporter for the New York Times, reported from Beijing for 6 years, and has been a non-practicing physician almost all of your career. Is that right?
Yeah, I worked in an emergency room for about 4 years before I say converting to journalism.
And it's funny because I've talked to a few authors or journalists who have their MDs.
Yeah.
And their sort of MO is that I can actually do more good for people. I can help or heal more people if I'm a diligent reporter than even if I'm a, you know, sort of circumspect physician.
Well, that was my intention from the beginning. I mean, I worked in an emergency room, and I ironically left journalism to write about the Clinton health reform at the New York Times in the 90s, because the problems I was seeing in the ER, I could try and solve patient by patient, but the problems were systemic. And in a way, that has led after 20 years to this book, because the problems now are so much greater even than they were then. And of course, you know, here we are again back at the table of health reform.
Do you think that we are better at least for Obamacare than we were without it?
Yes. I think, you know, nothing is perfect. And I think often in our health system, the looking for the perfect is the enemy of something pretty good. Obamacare did some really important things. It gave insurance to people with pre-existing conditions that was affordable. I mean, that was huge. There are 20 million more people who have insurance through Medicaid expansion and other parts of Obamacare. You know, there were plenty of things it didn't do very well. Some people experienced very high premium hikes. We still have 30 million people uninsured, which from the rest of the world looks pretty pretty outrageous.
Even today, 30 million people are not insured.
Yep.
Are they then 30 million taxpayers or 30 million people?
30 million people.
Yeah, I'm just wondering. I mean, the idea was that if you're not insured, then you at least have to pay a penalty, right?
Yeah. Well, the idea, and I think this was a fundamental game change for a country that was behind Obamacare, is that it's a government's job to try and provide affordable, decent health care to its people. That's a government obligation. And I think even if you repeal Obamacare, that sense of obligation is still there. And I think that's what we're seeing at the town hall meetings, people rising up and saying, wait, this isn't working for me, and you can't just take it away.
But is that revolutionary? It's a government obligation to provide reasonable health care. That's not in the Constitution, you know. That's not Thomas Jefferson didn't say that either.
It's revolutionary in the U.S. It's not revolutionary in most of the world.
But still, I mean, maybe that's, but we are in the U.S.
Right.
I wonder if that's at least a... We've obviously moved past that point, but I appreciate the sort of fundamental divide people would have about that issue. Maybe it's not the government's job to make sure everybody gets affordable health care, but we're going to go that direction, right?
Well, I think we're going to go that direction, and I think the problem with saying it's not the government's job is unless you're willing to not take care of people when they're sick, we all do end up paying, like it or not.
In the ERs, et cetera.
Yeah, in the ERs, in the cost of uncompensated care that happens at clinics that city health departments take care of.
Right.
It kind of falls back on our laps whether we like it or not.
Whether we like it or not. And then do you think that then, maybe this is the same question asked a different way, but some people also took exception to the notion that the government would mandate that you have health coverage or they would fine you if you did not. I guess, again, we've moved past that point. That's really the only way something like this works, right?
Right. And I think, you know, a lot of these things, we have this kind of reaction in the U.S., I don't want the government telling me what to do. But, you know, with smoking bans, with seatbelt laws, some things are the public good, and there's a lot of resistance, and then once it's there, we tend to accept it. Now, you know, saying that the government requires you to have health insurance doesn't necessarily tell you what kind of health insurance. I think you can look at it two ways. You can look at it as... you have to have health insurance so that the burden doesn't fall on society as a whole. So whether you like it or not, it's kind of like vaccines. You know, we want kids to get vaccinated because it's good for everyone.
I wonder if the media has done a good job reporting on this, because if you listen to talk shows or read the newspaper, it seems like you hear these heart-wrenching stories of people whose premiums and deductibles make insurance coverage really a non-issue for them. They can't afford it, and as they try to, they still never actually get to the threshold where they use
it.
And that we blame on the Affordable Care Act. So that it's a disaster. It's just ruinous. We don't take calls from people going, thank God for Obamacare because now I have coverage. I don't know where that silent majority is, but we don't hear about that a lot.
Well, I think we're seeing them rise up at the town halls, right? When suddenly there's this prospect of their insurance may be taken away. They're like, whoa, you can't do that. You know, this helped me get the drug I need, or it saved my kid. I think the narrative that these skyrocketing premiums are because of Obamacare is a bit of a false narrative. I think those of us who are lucky enough to have commercial insurance are also experiencing skyrocketing premiums, skyrocketing copays and deductibles. And I think that's a real problem that Obamacare didn't solve. And I think, you know, the issue is I really hate this notion that people don't want insurance. I think people want insurance. They just can't afford it often the way our insurance system is currently structured and with the prices we pay in healthcare, which are just way too high.
Yeah, that's what I want to get to. But do you think that the premiums and the deductibles, et cetera, people would be having those issues if Obamacare hadn't happened? Is that just a function of the marketplace and insurance in this country, or is it a function of the Obamacare program?
No, I think it's a function of the way we price and perform healthcare in this country. I think my book would have been true whether Obamacare was there or not, and it continues to be true even if there's some GOP replacement. It's a fundamental flaw in the way we do healthcare.
You talk about that a lot in the book. You have very specific instances from the patient's perspective where Suddenly something that in Canada or Mexico or Europe is so much less expensive is so insanely expensive here. And I found myself at times getting not so mad at the government or the insurance companies as I am either the providers or big pharma.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, everyone wants a bad guy. So everyone wants to be able to say,
right.
Oh, it's pharma, it's the hospital, it's, you know, it's this doctor. The truth is, it's the whole system. And it's the system that has evolved to accept these astronomical prices. And when people say, why are my premiums, why are my deductibles going up? The reason is because fundamentally, just the prices are too high. And if, guess what, your insurers, we like to say, oh, they're on your side. They're not on anyone's side. You know, your car insurer you don't think of as on your side, or your home insurer. They're pass-throughs. You know, they take in money from premiums and they pay it out in claims. And so if the prices are really high and your insurance tries to pay out, they're not going to eat those extra costs. They're going to pass them on to you. So part of the way we've gotten here is when people see these high prices that their insurance pays, they think, phew, I didn't have to pay that. My copay isn't so much. But guess what? You are paying. You'll pay next year for higher deductibles and higher premiums.
So what should happen? What's your prescription? Your book is kind of in two parts.
Yeah.
First, it's the malady, then it's the cure or some prescriptions for it. First, make sure I understand what the most critical parts are of the problem.
The central problem is high prices.
Okay.
I mean, that's pretty simple. And the secondary problem is if we're trusting the market to control those in healthcare, it won't, because it's not like any other market. I mean, we don't know prices ahead of time. We can't shop around. We get the bill afterwards. Somebody else is paying most of it if we're lucky.
Or,
anyway,
as you point out more than once, the price of X here is different than the price of X there.
Right. There is no price. What's the price for a vitamin D blood test? In the book, you can see it varies between $7 and $800 within a few miles. So how can you shop that way? Would you ever buy, you know, bread if that was the case? You wouldn't.
Or a Honda or right. something like that. It would be like if you went to Texas and Hondas were three times more expensive.
Right.
And you do sort of see that disparity, right? It makes no sense.
Oh, you see more than that. And that makes it impossible. You know, we're all being told, oh, be a good consumer. Well, without more price transparency and without more information, that's impossible. Someone said to me, she went to her local hospital because she was pregnant and didn't have insurance for that. And they said, oh, it'll be somewhere between $5,000 and $45,000. And she was like, you know, she's pregnant. She can't say, oh, well, then I'm not going to have my baby. You know, she just had to wait and see. And I said to her, so it's kind of like going to a restaurant with no prices on the menu. And she said, yeah, but at this restaurant, somebody else is always choosing what you get. And they're always choosing the most expensive thing on the menu.
Okay. So what's
Sorry.
The first? No, this all works. By the way, in our studio is Elizabeth Rosenthal. Her book is An American Sickness. She's speaking this evening at the Co-op Bookstore over by the University of Chicago, and she will be there at 6 o'clock this evening. More about that appearance in a minute. Okay, so that's the problem. Now, you actually do have some specific ideas about what we need to do next,
mm-hmm.
and I also want you to know, I want you to tell us what you think about what the current administration and Congress are thinking about.
Sure.
Are we on the right step? In a minute, on WGN, I'm John Williams. In our studio, Elizabeth Rosenthal, the author of An American Sickness. That's her latest book. She is the editor-in-chief of the Kaiser Health Network.
News.
Kaiser Health News. And she's going to be appearing at the Seminary Co-op Bookstore in Hyde Park over by U of C at 6 o'clock tonight. Okay. So you detailed before the break some of the problems.
Right.
What's the solution?
Well, and that's why the subtitle of the book is How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Because I think we can start to do things. So, you know, there are very practical tips that people can use to bring down the cost of healthcare for themselves. And I think that's the first step. You know, we have to ask for transparency and hold the medical world more accountable. How I do that, and this is why I know these things work, because researching this book has changed the way I interact with the system. So, for example, you go to a doctor's office and the doctor says, why don't we just get these blood tests? You know, your antenna should go up, right? Okay, fine. Your doctor's computer is most likely now programmed to send your blood to his hospital lab. And that's going to be really expensive. Hospital labs will cost hundreds of dollars what outside labs may charge $10 for. So I say to my doctor, okay, fine, but can you send this to Quest or LabCorp because they're in my network and they're cheaper. So you can ask that. Your doctor may have to take a little extra step and write out a requisition.
He might make
works.
A face. He might not like that.
No, but I talk to a lot of doctors' groups too, and I think, you know, they will have to change the way they partner with their patients to, and you know what? Doctors don't like it that their patients are being ripped off. If you see in the book, some of the best sources I have are doctors who write to me and say, one guy, Dr. Jeffrey Crespin in New York, he said he was doing colonoscopies and he was sending the biopsies off to one of the hospitals in New York. And he said suddenly his patients were calling saying, doc, did you know they're charging me $1,000 and they're out of network? So he called me. He said, I'm pissed that my patients are being ripped off. So he found another lab. Now, physicians can do that. I know they didn't go to medical school to negotiate, but I think they don't feel good about these prices either.
But aren't there instances where they are sending the biopsy or the blood test to an agency that they themselves own or have some financial interest in?
Well, and that's why I think we should all be doing a little bit of advanced homework before we choose a doctor or choose a hospital. And one of the things I'd like to know from a doctor's practice is, A, do you own labs? Do you own the x-ray equipment? B, do you charge concierge fees? I hear from all of these patients.
And those are great.
This is crazy, you know, where you go to a doctor and you're in the practice and then suddenly they say, oh, you know, you have to write us a check for $1,000. And when the patients say, what for? They say, oh, it's so we answer your, because we answer your calls promptly, we'll see you in the hospital. And I'm like, wait, this is what doctors do. This is not, you know, they shouldn't be doing this for tips.
Okay, so I had some skin cancer taken off of my leg recently, yeah. And I went to a relatively new medical facility. It was awesome. Yeah. Not only did they have valet parking, they had people walking around the front lobby area like young people that work at an Apple store. They all had tablets and they boop, 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 right. Immediately knew who I was and where I should be and sent me on my way. And when I got up there, it was kind of a large suite area with coffee machines and water stations and comfortable chairs, and I thought it was just the most organized, pleasant experience I ever had, and I was there for cancer surgery. It was just positively lovely, and I felt good about that. Your
you
thoughts?
Shouldn't. you shouldn't feel so good about it. That was probably the most expensive. How much did it cost?
$1 zillion.
Right, exactly.
Actually, I don't know.
Right, because you didn't pay it. Now, and this is...
I'll get a bill.
You'll get the bill. And this is why I tell everyone to look at their explanation of benefit statements and push back. There's one man in the book, Dr. Jeffrey Kivy, who had an infusion of some medicine for his arthritis at one hospital for $19,000 every month. Okay, that sounds like a lot of money. But then his rheumatologist moved uptown 20 blocks in New York to another hospital, and suddenly those same infusions were over $100,000. This is, and Dr. Kivy said to me, you know, I thought it might be a little more expensive. You know, the infusion rooms were really nice, and there was free Wi-Fi and cookies and water. But, you know, we are paying for this stuff, right? We are paying for it. And he, because he's like me, he's kind of a wonk and understands that the connection, went after the hospital, it was NYU Medical Center, and said, $100,000, that's crazy. And they said, you know, well, nobody pays it, your insurance will cover it. He had great insurance. And he said, that's not the point. Because he understood that if his insurer is covering $100,000 infusions, then all of our premiums are going up next year and all of our deductibles are going up.
I'm asking you, what are some of the solution sides? And so you said, yeah. Well, we need more transparency, and it happens if patients ask for it. So I want to know, are you in network and are you doing the lab work here or outside the lab or the hospital? What else? What else should we do to push back?
You can say, if I need an x-ray, send me to a place that does it for $500 rather than $5,000. And your doctor's first answer may be, gee, I don't know that. But you know what? That is what doctors will have to learn, because I want my doctor to be the kind of person who's in my corner who will say to the $5,000 center, I'm not going to refer my patients to you if you're charging that much.
And it might take longer. We're going to have to find this place. We're going to send them off, and you won't be enough, be longer.
And it may be a hassle. I mean, I went outside of a hospital for an MRI for one of my kids. it saved a ton of money, but it meant that crazily in this world of online connectivity, I had to pick up the scan and walk it to the doctor's office. I'm like, can't you send that? And they're like, no, you know, our electronic records don't interact with theirs. That should change, but it will change if more of us make the effort to go outside of the system to save ourselves some money and our whole medical system to push back against these prices. They exist because we've allowed them to skyrocket this way.
The new Congress was unable to replace Obamacare.
Yeah.
How did you score that? Is it good that they were not successful, or were you rooting for them to make some changes?
Well, I guess my bottom line is just like President Obama's, that if they have a way to do it better and cheaper and cover more people, like, hallelujah, go for it. But I would say we haven't seen that way. And healthcare is like a complicated Rubik's Cube. You know, you can't just say, oh, we're going to, you know, do high risk pools and then everything else will work itself out. So I haven't seen anything from the GOP side that is a real solution in a more global way.
Yeah.
And we haven't faced prices directly in any of these things. We haven't said to Medicare, you can negotiate drug prices, as every other developed country does. We haven't said to government agencies like PCORI, take into account how much things cost. We don't have an agency like NICE in England, which says, what should this new medicine cost? What's it worth? We don't do that in this country, and we're all paying for not doing it.
You hear often, we need to be able to purchase health care across state lines.
Yeah.
Does that mean anything, and would that make a difference if we change the law regarding that?
No, I mean, this has been tried before, and you can, if you think like an economist, you can see why it probably wouldn't work, because the states that have the lowest requirements for insurance will develop these bare-bones plans, and then yeah, people will be able to buy inadequate insurance. I mean, the person I referred to who had to pay for her pregnancy out of pocket, she had insurance, but this was before Obamacare. And insurance in those days didn't necessarily cover maternity care. So do you want to worry about when you're buying a policy, in-network, out-of-network, does it cover maternity care? Does it cover skin cancer care? I mean, this business of people should shop every year for insurance, this is an incredible burden to put on people. You just want to know that it covers kind of the things that medically people need, I think.
Elizabeth Rosenthal's book is An American Sickness. I left my copy on my nightstand. All of my notes and cursives and things are scribbled in there. The subtitle of the book is
How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back.
She's going to be at the Seminary Co-op Bookstore in Hyde Park at the U of C tonight at 6 o'clock. Run for Congress, will you? Run for president. Run for health czar. I have confidence in you, Elizabeth. I want you to be in charge.
Well, I'm hoping the book will seed those people who are in charge now, because there is a lot we can do both individually and from a policy perspective. And a lot of it is not from Washington, where we may not get a lot of action, but at the state level. So there are lots of ideas in the book, and I hope people run with them. And maybe someday that it will be me.
Thanks for coming into our studio.
Thank you.
239. Thank you, Kim. It's John. Hey, I've got some Spamalot tickets to give away. No, wait. Spamilton. Spamilton. Who was it that was on this fine radio station saying that they saw it and thought it was just terrific? I'm trying to remember who that was now. Anyway, was it Stantis? Yeah, Scott Stantis and his wife. On the Mincing Rascals podcast, we're talking about it. Stantis had seen Hamilton, and he wasn't one for these spoof parodies. He said somehow or another he found himself in the audience at the Royal George, and he thought it was just hilarious. And I said, well, do I need to have seen Hamilton in order to appreciate Spamilton? He said, it helps, because some of them are song parodies, and it spoofs the show itself. But he said, no, you do not have to. He said, you can go either way. You can see Hamilton without seeing Spamilton, and you can see Spamilton without seeing Hamilton. But it helps if you do. So we'll give away a pair of tickets to that in about 10, 15 minutes. Before 3 o'clock when Roe and Anna come in here on WGN, it's 2:40. So I have here some of the bullet point points of the White House tax plan. And I got to tell you, I am so 100% on board. Heather Long joins us now, too. By the way, I hope that didn't sound sarcastic, because I think I am. Heather Long is on the line, the CNN senior writer and editor She joins us on WGN. Hi, Heather. It's John Williams. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm good. I'm well, thanks.
The reason I catch myself is because I also don't believe you can do this. I don't think this just looks too good. I'm like, if you can do all of this, great. But I worry for our country if we have this many givebacks. First, just give me the big picture here. What did the president propose today?
Well, we got a big promise for tax cuts for individuals, tax cuts for businesses, both big and small. A lot of talk about the business rate going from a high of 35% all the way down to 15%. So that 15% would, again, apply to both big corporations and small kind of family-owned businesses. On the personal income side, also some decent-sized tax cuts there. They would consolidate the current system. We have 7 rates in the country to just 3 rates, and they would raise what's called the standard deduction, and that's really the channel that would give a lot of middle class folks a bit of a tax.
They want to double that. They want to double the standard deduction. How about that?
That's right. That's right. And they said they would keep the mortgage one. So if you buy a home, I used to own a home, and that's a real big help on those tax returns when you can write off some of that mortgage interest. So they said they would keep that and the charitable deduction. There was a lot of question about whether they would get rid of the charitable deduction. But those two are remaining. We did not get any other details, though, on what other parts of the tax, you know, personal income tax they might tweak.
Well, as I understand it, what they want to do is, you're right, increase by twofold the standard deduction. They'll still let you deduct your mortgage interest and your charitable contributions, but there will be no other deductions on the personal income side. So now I'm scratching my head thinking, okay, well, most of my deductions are charitable and mortgage interest, but I guess I have some private business deductions. If I travel, I get 50 cents a mile or something like that. I wonder what those other deductions are now that they're going to eliminate from us.
Exactly. That's the big open question. And so if we had younger folks on the line, they would probably be saying, and what about the write-offs for student loans, for various forms of debt, other forms of debt that are also part of the current tax plan? So, you know, that's whether or not, you know, people like you and I or your listeners are going to be better off is going to come down to what's going to happen with some of those other exemptions on the forms.
Right, because I'm able to lower my taxes through some of these other deductions. If I lose those, I'm going to have to pay more. But then you say, yeah, but your rate's going to be lower. Maybe it'll be a push. I mean, this thing is not revenue neutral, is it? It's supposed to actually cost the government money, correct?
Yeah, that's we've been calling it at CNN magical thinking from the Trump administration. So they've been trying to argue. They had their Treasury Secretary and their top economic advisor, Gary Cohn, all over today, the TV and whatnot, trying to say, look, we think we're doing big enough tax cuts that this is going to pay for itself because it's going to spur economic growth, and we're just going to get a lot more revenue as companies grow more and as more people go back to work. That line of argument has been used before, and it has not happened. So there's a lot of skepticism about whether or not this is going to add to the debt, and pretty much anybody who's not in the Trump administration admits, yes, the plan, as it's currently stated, would add massively to the debt.
Is that a version of Reaganomics or the Reagan tax plan, the trickle-down?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So this is the return of trickle-down economics. And, you know, look, you can debate how much it's going to help the stock market, how much it's going to help job creation, how much it's going to help growth. It will probably help those a little bit, but it's not going to help them enough to make it somehow that we're going to get so much revenue that's going to offset what we're losing by these big tax cuts.
Do they also talk about how they want to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure, and are they still sticking with that?
That's a really good point. So part of the reason the stock market's up so high and part of the reason that people have been saying this is such a pro-growth administration is because infrastructure was supposed to be part of the economic plan. Now, they've paid lip service to it. Trump continues to talk about wanting to do an infrastructure plan. So do his head honchos from the economic team. However, there have been even fewer details released about that. So what we saw today was sort of bare bones. It was a one-pager that came out with various bullet points about what they want to do on taxes. That's not really a tax plan. You know, that's some basic bullet points.
Wait a minute.
I haven't even seen that much on infrastructure.
Are you seriously? This tax proposal? I thought it would be one of those things where they wheel out the cart and it has these big, bound, blue-covered, gigantic tax proposals. It's a one-pager?
That's right. Yep, that's right. So that's why there's still a lot of hesitation to read too much into this. It looks very similar to what he proposed on the campaign, but it's hard to even analyze what the impact is going to be on middle class or on businesses when you only have a couple of bullet points to go by. So there's a lot of work still to be done.
Well, what do I know, Heather? Maybe that's how you do these things. You roll out the broad, sort of perspective, and then you ask the Congress and staff to fill in the details. I'm not laughing here. Maybe that's not as absurd as it sounds to me at first.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt that it's not like this was going to be done tomorrow or done next week, right? So the earliest anyone was talking about doing something was by August, and now that's almost a laughable deadline because there are still a lot to be hammered out, even between the same parties, so even between the White House and the Republicans in Congress. There's still some differences that need to be worked through. And it comes back to those basic questions that you were asking, which is how much do we want this to add to the deficit and our debt? So if they want to add less, they're going to have to tweak some of that. Those, the giveaways may not be as sweet. The tax cuts may not be as deep if we don't want to add debt for our children and grandchildren. And similarly, they're going to look at these plans in more detail, and they're also going to say, how much of a giveaway do we want to give to the wealthy and to the corporations versus to the middle and middle class and working class?
By your estimation, is this good for the wealthy? Is it who benefits most from this?
Yeah. My take is this, and I'm kind of a pretty centrist person. I would say, look, there is definitely a benefit in this tax plan, at least what we know so far, for the middle class. But he's doing a little for the middle class and a lot for the wealthy. And I think that's probably the key takeaway of what we've seen so far. Whether that balance shifts as the process goes on, we'll see.
Top rate will be 35%, not 39%. We'll still have graduated income taxes, but it'll be three levels, 35, 25, and 10. But they didn't say where your income puts you in between. Well, so am I going to be 25, 10, or 35? When do I go from one to the other? We don't know that, right?
That's correct.
Well, that's kind of huge.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that there's a nut right there. They're also going to eliminate the death tax. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's one of the huge sticking points. A lot of times people talk about, I know you're there in Illinois, some of my family is actually from Illinois and owned farmland, and so a lot of people always talk about, that death tax really hurts the family farmer. The reality is if you look at the data, you have to have a property that's valued over about $5 million for that to kick in. So it's a very, very small number of family-owned businesses or family-owned properties that would currently even face the quote-unquote death tax or estate tax. Well, so a lot of people view that as a giveaway to the rich. For instance, the Trump family could benefit from it.
Oh, stop. Heather Long's on the phone line. I'll let you go, Heather. Just two last quick questions. A, where are you from? What's the family farm?
Well, my mom's family is from Illinois, from Urbana-Champaign area, and still owns some farmland in sort of the Peoria area.
No kidding.
I come from Pennsylvania, so I come from dairy country in the Harrisburg-Hershey area of Pennsylvania. So we're pretty well aware of the impact on family farms and small businesses.
The most fertile land on earth is in Urbana and Champaign, and I cut my teeth at WMBD in Peoria, so you and I go way back.
Small world.
Finally, are Republicans liking this? Are enough of them, or are any Democrats saying thumbs up?
Yeah, I haven't seen any. any Democrats say thumbs up yet. So that's, but they don't necessarily need them, depending upon how they decide to do this.
Right.
Some of my colleagues who are in Congress today, I'm based in New York, did ask, start asking around on the House and different Republicans. And I think the key takeaway so far has been that they like what they're hearing. They like the basics. There's broad agreement to reduce taxes, certainly from the GOP, but they are not very happy at the idea of adding so much to the deficits and debt.
You get a car, and you get a car, and you get a car. Everybody's going to get a car. Sorry, I just was giving stuff away. All right, listen, Heather, it's nice to talk to you. Let's visit again, senior writer and editor at CNN Money. We sure appreciate your time and expertise, Heather. Well done.
Thank you. Take care.
I don't think she got my you get a car and you get a car and you get a car thing. But doesn't it seem like everybody gets a car in this thing? Flailing around here for a piece of paper was, I just wanted to see the story of the bunny rabbit that died on. Was it United or American Airlines?
I can look it up for you.
Was it United? I know it's one of those killer airlines, one of those ones that just beats the poor animals to death. Which one was it?
Of course it's United because they can't get a break.
Well, American isn't exactly having a stellar week either. By the way, I have some questions to give away, but I think you're right, Judy. I think it's United.
Oh, I am
it is.
Right.
It's United?
I'm absolutely right.
I have tickets to give away to Spamalot, the hilarious musical that roasts Hamilton and Lin-Manuel Miranda, now playing at the Royal George Theater. Critics are raving, so get your tickets at Spamalot.com. You will get a pair of tickets if you call right now, 312-981-7200, and answer correctly this question. What was I referencing when I said you get a car and you get a car? Violetta says that however well-intended that was, I didn't do it correctly. Here now is Violetta doing the correct version of the you get a car line. Go.
You get a car and you get a car and you get a car.
Judy, let's hear you do it.
No.
I mean, she's just very excited. Are we allowed to say who, or you're waiting for your caller?
Well, all the lines are ringing.
Oh, I bet.
I think they know who it was. But did my point make sense, at least, Violetta? Judy, it's like, this tax plan's great.
Yes, I would have added, and nobody has to pay.
I know, that's the thing. Look, I'm not a big fan of the president. You may have heard me say that before. But if he can pull this off, I'm going to vote for him again. I may vote for him two more times. If they can make this thing go, if they can bring everybody's taxes down.
Again?
And what? What'd I say?
You said you're going to vote for him again?
I guess it would be the first time if I voted for him at all.
Don't be shaking up my world, John.
Do not see that one coming. Julie. You're on the air. You're on WGN. Hi, Julie. How are you? Breaker, breaker, Julie. Yeah, looks like she's still talking to Elif off the air. But we do have a winner. It is Oprah Winfrey. She was the reference point that we were making. And she gets a car.
She gave away cars.
She gave away cars.
To everyone.
I know. And they did. And actually, now that you mention it, Violetta, the people did have to pay for them then. Wasn't there a little bit of stink when she gave away the cars? Because if you give somebody a $20,000 Chrysler, they then end up having to pay a tax on that. It costs them several thousand dollars for winning the car. So all those women in the audience that were crying.
And they complained.
And well, I kind of.
No, you have to pay tax on it. Except possibly under this new tax plan, I'm not sure. That
you
might
get a car,
go away.
And you don't have to pay for it. All right, it's 2:56. Ro and Anna are in our studio next on GM. Ro Khan, Anna DeVlantis in the studio. Hi, kids.
Couldn't be busier,
Hi, John.
Could not be a busier few hours ahead of us.
Really?
Yes. We're going to talk about presidents, not Warren G. Harding, although he may come up a little bit later on.
Other than Donald Trump, you're going to talk about presidents?
No, just Donald Trump.
Okay, that's enough.
And the tax. Okay, so here's what's happening. We got Congressman Kinzinger. He's on his way to a secret meeting about North Korea. How secret could it be since I just said it? But whatever. We're going to talk about the North Korean tensions and the tax proposal that has just been released. A one-page tax proposal.
I just found that out.
So simple.
Isn't that weird? No, yeah. Not a lot of detail at all.
I'm shocked to hear that.
It sounds like an eighth grade term paper.
Uh-huh.
One page.
How can the tax code
Big
be
letters.
Reduced to one page?
The end at the bottom.
Right.
The
changes at least.
It's a college senior's resume, as it was described by our producer. So it is. So what we will we'll talk about what it is, though. And what is it? Is it just the beginning of a negotiation? All that Congress will tell us about that. And then the former ambassador to Canada from the United States is going to be joining us about this trade war that has now been the shot has been fired. And actually what that means for Chicago. because Chicago specifically has an issue here.
Seriously.
A gigantic issue, gigantic skin in the game here.
Because I was talking to my wife the other day, and I said, you know, Brenda, this soft lumber issue has really got me torched, and
we need to crack down on it.
Sure, I know. It's hard to relate to, except for housing prices potentially going up. But then you have our friends in Wisconsin who are impacted.
And let me just tell you, there's nothing sadder than soft lumber.
Don't text that.
Oh, and then there's...
That's right. We were talking about housing when I brought that
We got to do something
separate
about that.
Conversation.
Call your physician. Mm-hmm. And let me just say this, that we have a dead rabbit on an airplane.
I know. I was so saddened by that.
Who killed the rabbit?
On a United flight.
Yeah. We're going to find out what happened to the rabbit. Ew. Who knew that there were 4 feet tall rabbits?
This
Are
was,
you serious?
It was
that big?
Yeah.
It's like
4 feet tall.
Its lineage stems from a Guinness World Record winner. Mm-hmm.
So this is no ordinary rabbit.
Very special.
When they heard the rabbit die, they go, well, I hope it's not a famous rabbit or an important rabbit. They go, we got bad news for you. It's like the world record.
If you hear the rabbit die, VIP. That could mean something else, too. Like, oh, no. That wasn't me. You have to be over a certain age to understand that reference.